Brainstorm Brewery is brought to you by GatheringMagic.com and CoolStuffInc.com. Show your support. Welcome, everyone, to a milestone for Brainstorm Brewery. We're here at episode 83.
83 is a milestone?
Yeah, people will be like, what? Why is that a milestone? Well, because in episode 42, Mikasa Tsukasa, that was our first episode that we did on Gathering Magic. And 83 means that we have crossed over and we've spent more time on Gathering Magic than we had elsewhere. So it's a milestone for us. And to pay homage to this, we brought the big boss man himself. We got Adam Staborski, the Stibs.
Now would be a good time to say hi, Adam.
That's where I'm supposed to say hi.
Yeah. That's the hi. Adam Staborski hello, 15 seconds of awkward silence.
It's going to cut down to one. Won't even notice.
You should stretch it out.
That's the worst, man. I love awkward silence.
But we get plenty of it every week.
See, I used to podcast with Adam on Monday Night Magic, and I used to we record and there would be some awkward silence, and I go back and listen to it. I was like, what happened? And that's the power of editing. And then you realize later on what you can do to a podcast. And you can make something that we have that we re-recorded that sound very horrible to sound, you know, somewhat digestible.
So. Most of that is used from what I can't think smart. Of the card name.
Well, what?
Well, Adam said we're going to make him sound smart, and I said... most of the awkward silence editing is when I can't think of a card name, but we both said it at the same time. And you can't separate them because the power of editing won't help with that.
Unless you have it on different tracks. If it was fancy, you could.
Oh, we could do it. I don't get paid enough to do that work, though.
Or at all.
Yeah.
So why don't we start off with Adam telling everybody kind of what his role is, what he does, how much EDH he plays.
Well, I play all the EDH, all the time, except when I'm playing Cube. I'm the content manager for Gathering Magic, so basically all of the articles, when you love them, I totally helped make that happen, probably pitched the idea, made it, you know, almost 100% responsible, except for, you know, creating all the words that you actually read. And for all the articles and whatever that you don't like, it's totally the fault of whoever wrote it or sent it in. You know, I must have been, like, sleeping on the job when I posted that, so
that sounds real personal. It sounds like the great idea of who to follow was me, and the poor execution of who to follow was Jason.
Yeah, I mean, you hit the nail on the head.
That sounds about right. You know,
the truth comes out; it's all Jason's fault.
I also write the Thursday column command tower on Daily MTG. So if you like Commander and you read that column, great. Keep giving me your responses. I do coverage, contract with the Wizards coverage team, so I'll do text coverage at Grand Prix events and help them out. I think that's it for now.
that's
all the magical. That's the magical stuff that I do.
That's one heck of a plate right there. It's quite full. So how do you like writing for the mother side itself? How's that experience for you?
It's good. If I didn't enjoy it, I probably would have stopped. It's great. I mean, working, I get to work with Aurelia team. You know, I get good ideas. I get to work with previews and get to do some really cool content, you know, looking ahead, doing a column that's basically focused on reader feedback is really interesting because, you know, I know that I can only play so much Commander. And even if I go online and even if I, you know, dedicated myself wholly to playing Commander and over and over and over, I'm still not going to see every angle and everything that everybody else sees. So getting a chance to gather all of that together and not only see a way more Commander than I can possibly take a look at, but also share that and kind of, curate that so other people can have that same experience. I love it. It's great.
I mean, talking about Commander every week seems difficult to do. Maybe that's just because I don't play a ton of Commander. And when I do, I just try to combo people out, but I think it's impressive to be able to write about that format every week.
I think it's impressive to write about Standard every week. I mean,
yes, you know, I mean, it's pretty hard to care about.
You know, I mean, you know, and that's the real, you know, that's the real kind of challenge with anything that you want to write about over and over and over is, you know, the idea that there's only so many veins to kind of run down and flush out. You know, I think with Commander, there are so many ways to look at things, so many interesting things to talk about. You know, Commander can cover everything from really powerful combo decks that are, you know, I find kind of boring all the way out through, you know, just like random piles of cards and like what you can do with like, oh, this box of foils I found. You know, I mean, that's a Commander article I saw this week. You know, so I think it's, you know, I think it's much more difficult to talk about something where you need to have deck lists that are competitive, consistent, you know, where information, you know, the time that you get information with respect to when you write and publish your article is really sensitive. You know, I think it's way more challenging to write engaging content, you know, in that way. You know, most Commander articles, you can, you know, they have a much longer shelf life, I feel, because it, you know, things change slower. And even the things that are timely are great to look back because 5 years from now, the one guy who wrote an article about all the different random cards in Theros that seemed awesome for Commander is going to be still be really exciting for somebody who's never seen Theros before and really wants to find, you know, a handful of neat cards that, you know, go with this Greco-Roman themed deck.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good point, actually, especially with finance stuff. Stuff is pretty much dead the week or two after you write it.
Yeah, and it was standard also, like, you know, if somebody else more important says it already, then what are you saying when you do your article? So it gives you a sense to be distinctive and really give you that edge.
I mean, it is no surprise that, you know, Patrick Chapin's competitive article goes up pretty much every Monday on Star City.
Yeah, and you can't write more words than he can. Let's put it like that. So what about Gathering Magic? Tell us about this. You took over as the lead editor. What is exactly your role?
I'm the content manager, so the less actual traditional editing I do, the better. I'm not a very good traditional editor. We have a great copy editor, Andrew Wilson. He does a lot of the grammatical corrections, the formatting, tagging. Has a bunch of really clever macros that set the articles up in the back end. So my job is just the overall direction, social media. Do a lot of like the blurbs that we'll put up on Facebook, Twitter, things like that. I work closely with Heather and all the, Revised Angel, Heather Lafferty, all the work that she's doing. You know, she helps out on Twitter and Facebook and, helps manage some of our, you know, our broader social reach, Tumblr, Pinterest, places like that. Basically, it's a lot of the, kind of the news and urgency side of things. So whether it's submissions coming in, writers and their content, that need feedback, scheduling, things like that, you know, I'll handle a lot of the logistics and back-end kind of duties.
Okay, there's been a lot of good articles and new writers that have joined the team. What has been your vision? Is there a vision that you have been trying to reach as far as taking Gathering Magic with the addition of new writers?
Yes and no. I mean, I think that, you know, what I would always look for are people that are really passionate about something that they love in Magic. And they have the ability to share that passion in a way that people can relate to, you know, and whether it's a podcast, whether it's, you know, about art, whether it's finance, whether it's, you know, the decks that they play, the formats that they're enjoying, you know, I that's the kind of stuff that I glom at. You know, I like to see a diversity of things. You know, I think it can get kind of tiring very quickly to read a lot of, you know, 5 or 6 standard articles in a week. You know, let alone on the same site. You know, you just start to run into a little bit of redundancy or, you just start to not believe it. You know, if you have 5 people tell you a different deck is the best deck, you know, it kind of defeats the point a little bit. You know, it comes with some good things, but, you know, the kind of the overall goal for Gathering Magic is to deliver, thoughtful content. And that's, you know, that's kind of the paradigm that I really try to help build towards.
The thoughtful content, then why did you pick us up? Because we're definitely not that.
Like I said, sometimes I'm just sleeping on the job and I don't even know what happened. It's been a year and I still don't know what this cast is about.
Yeah, it also seems like with Gathering Magic, like you really look to pick up a more diverse, like you said, not necessarily all standard, but even just, you don't see a lot of these other websites picking up like the artists and stuff like that.
Yeah,
I really like that. Was that really your vision, was to kind of encompass everything? Because I noticed, since you've taken over, it seems like a lot more of that has made it on there. And I mean, I like the kind of the broad reach that Gathering Magic has gained, because you bring a lot of people who may have been interested in art who aren't necessarily interested in finance or standard, but are interested in modern, and maybe they can find a modern article on there or something like that. It seems like there's more than one thing on the website for every person who comes there.
I mean, that's just good. You know, it's just a good standard practice to have. I mean, you want to be able to satisfy all of your customers, so you stock a lot, you know, a variety of things, you know. So if you want to call readers of Magic content customers, you know, I want to have something in stock for them every week. You know, but moreover, it's really about diversification. You know, like, there are only so many top players in the world that you can get to write articles. There are only so many, pieces of content that you can, not pieces of content, but, you know, ideas for content, I think that can appear on every site and feel fresh and new and different from each other. You know, so I you know, and it kind of reaches back to being thoughtful, is that if I can find somebody that talks about this really awesome thing that they're passionate about, and they're really good at you know, conveying that passion, I think that resonates better, regardless of whether you're particularly interested in it or not. And I think that's kind of the surprising thing, you know, that I've gotten in the feedback about Gathering Magic, is that somebody will say, oh, I read an article and I usually don't, but, you know, and they follow it with something positive, or like, you know, I really like that, what they were saying, you know. And I think that's kind of the theme, you know, that ties together the variety of stuff, is that if somebody can take a look at it and get drawn into it, you know, even if it's once, or, you know, it doesn't have to be all the time, but if they enjoy something that they don't typically enjoy, you know, I find that that's a success that sets us apart from other sites.
Completely agree. Like, I just read the Be Kind, by Rada, and I thought that was particularly good. It's about, you know, Modo and how bad people treat each other, and how we just need to, you know, respect each other as players. And, you know, it didn't go get overly sappy, like, you know, how some people try to spin their articles, and it felt like there was an honest message there, and I like that. So, doing well.
Yeah, and I mean, that was totally Rada's brainchild, and she came up with it on her own. It was something she was really interested in. She did research. She, you know, talked to Natasha Lewis Harrington, you know, somebody who's working on her degree in the psychology field, and wants to, you know, got some feedback from her about, you know, references and strategies and things like that, you know, and the you know, admittedly, you know, I, you know, there are probably some execution issues with the article. You know, I got a bunch of feedback, from a bunch of different editors, and a lot of conflicting feedback too, which is really interesting. So it's just, you know, good discussion there aside, but, you know, the target of the article wasn't to say, these are bad things, look at these bad people. It's, hey, you know, these are things that we do and have a real effect. And here are strategies for dealing with it. Here are things that can help you if you're a victim of it. Here's things that you can do if you know that you're prone to do it. And it's not about blaming the victim, but about, you know, finding constructive ways to talk about and discuss this issue. And, you know, I think that's probably what you picked up on.
It's not unique to Magic either. There was a really good lecture that one of the Riot Games crew gave about toxic communities and what they're doing on League of Legends. If I can find that again, I'm going to jam that in the show notes. That's about a half hour talk. It's really worth watching.
They do a lot of research like on the statistics of how what they do as a company to try to cut down on some of this behavior actually affects players. You know, because they have millions and millions of games of data to pull from.
You know, how it affects people closing their accounts after they haven't been playing long, or, you know, recommending the game to people. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely remember seeing that. I'm checking my bookmarks now to see if I have a bookmark somewhere. But the tribunal process is something that I'm a very big fan of. You know, it isn't necessarily the most effective tool for everything, but having other members of the community evaluate the behavior of community members and discuss it, and, you know, determine what's appropriate to act on, I think is a layer of both transparency and involvement that makes it empowering to discuss things socially in the game. You know, I don't play it, but, you know, maybe you can speak to it a little bit, Corbin, but it feels very different from this, you know, like Moto Police Facebook group type situation.
Yeah, if you're playing the game, and like the sobering part of it is it truly, it makes a difference, but it doesn't change how bad the community is. Basically, you have a bunch of young people, a lot of teenagers playing the game, and people rage, and people are very, very mean and rude and all of this stuff. But having the tribunal, the fact that at the end of a game you can report somebody and know that people do get banned, and it actually does something. It kind of gives some empowerment back to the people who were harassed in game to try to affect it moving forward. So, like, you know, there's still a lot of bad games with people. And at the end of the game, you know, that game was bad, but you can at least tell yourself that you're doing something to try to prevent it in the future. So,
it's funny that the computer sort of fosters that bad behavior in people, because you see that to a much lesser extent IRL. You're not going to say, "I hope you die in a fire" to somebody's face.
Right.
Well, you might, but I mean...
No, it's a joke.
For the most part, yeah.
For the most part, you're not going to have the balls to say that to somebody's face, and something about the anonymity of the internet kind of emboldens people, and for whatever reason, they kind of lash out in a way they wouldn't face to face. And I think that's very interesting.
Yeah, I think definitely they need to incorporate into Modo is a social aspect, and your accounts should be tied socially, DCI number as such, and that'd be like your public presence. And I the fact that they're not working on something like that shows how far behind they are actually on a Modo client.
Yeah, if they had the client stable, then maybe they could move on to trying to create some sort of system for suspending players or banning accounts, something to try to clean up the behavior, but I don't even think that's a point they're at yet.
Yeah.
Yeah, right now, if someone behaves badly, the next Magic Online Championship series they're in crashes.
So you guys want to move into picks of the week?
Well,
change gears.
I'll tell you what I'm picking before we get into our picks of the week is I'm picking the new card frame. I am a fan of it. What do you guys
think? Oh, I knew somebody would like it, and I knew it would be you, you moron.
Actually, you know what? The proxy guide, he did a Sphinx's Revelation in the new card frame. It didn't look that bad. And actually, I kind of liked it.
Someone shipped me the link. I haven't been online today.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I'm way behind.
I don't hate it. I think the comment I made on QS this week was they changed the card frame because they got all my letters where I begged them to do that. I don't hate it, but I guess I don't understand why they felt it was necessary.
Okay, well, consider that, I'll just say that I saw a link, I didn't actually get into it, but something about a high quality counterfeit cards coming into the market recently.
What
they're doing with adding the little hollow thing at the bottom for rares and mythics is that makes it harder to counterfeit. I like that the black on the edges is a little less pronounced now because they get a bigger text box, which is always good. More room for the art, that's always good. It's going to make miscuts a little more interesting, incidentally. The one thing I'm not sure about is how it slopes off at the bottom and has the black text.
That's the biggest problem that I'm sure everyone has, and it's the most jarring part about the card. I think over time we will get used to it. It's just right now it's such a different change that it's just shocking.
You know what I'm not hearing though? I was around in 8th edition, and when they changed the borders, you heard, there weren't many great message boards back then, so I was a part of bad message boards, and everyone was like, "I'm quitting!" Cool, you'll be missed. You know, I haven't heard that this time around, I think because everyone knows it's an empty threat. Well, like, no one believes you when you say you're going to quit.
Yeah. Like, at the end of the day, it's an extremely minor change. Like, your cards look a little different, but if you're quitting over something like that, come on.
Sure, the Pro Tour scene will miss you.
I like the implications that this could do. Like, you could the fact that they can have card readers take this, they could pre-register decks. You can go to, like, GP Vegas, and they don't have to go there and register the decks yourself. He just hands you a pack of cards, and you're ready to go and play. You know, especially, you know, deck checks or something. You do a quick, fast deck check. I think there's things they're going to be able to do with the card reader that's going to make it worthwhile. Otherwise, they wouldn't take up so much real estate on the actual card.
Well, how would it be readable? Is it just the holofoil thing? Because I think that's only on the rares and mythics.
No, it's the numbers. The numbers are readable. The mythic signs.
Oh, okay.
All that is completely readable by software, so they can sort.
To kind of jump on that off that on a tangent, at the risk of sounding like a moron by agreeing with Corbin, I think the new frame. Did I do it right, guys? That's how it's supposed to work, right?
Corbin's the whipping boy. We don't like you much.
You know, the that bottom part of the card, I think that, you know, right now the OCR, the optical character recognition software, is built for when they produce at the plant, you know, but it doesn't take a leap for, you know, better camera optics to be incorporated into something like where, for example, if you have an Android tablet or a phone, you can literally just flick through the cards and it'll automatically count, catalog, and put your cards where they need to be in a collection, you know. And then imagine this where if you're playing at a pro tour, you know, where they have the, you know, like a poker table, right? They have like little pocket cameras. They have a little sensor where, like, you know, wherever they set the card, like, they know what the cards are, or they can know that, like the scanners that scan, like, whether a card has blackjack or not.
Mm-hmm.
You could imagine a system where they have these tables where whenever a player draws a card, they just pull it over this one spot and it automatically picks it up, feeds in the card information, to, you know, to the cards in hand tool that they have for coverage. You know, that's the real future. Is everything that people have been asking for in terms of efficiency and making, you know, information more accessible for coverage, more accessible offline, I think, is really a big advantage coming soon because of this change.
You can really make coverage way easier just because you don't even have to necessarily show exactly what's happening on the table so much as you could recreate it digitally at times too. Like, it just makes it a lot easier to be able to zoom in and see things without having to do it on actual camera. Like, you can show situations just because of that card reader being there. And on top of that, it also prevents a lot of cheating. I mean, you're not going to be able to slide a card back into your deck if, you know, it was just previously obviously in your hand because the reader saw it was there or something like that. I don't know that that'll be a major impact of it, but if that does happen for coverage, I think it's great for any form of that kind of, you know, anything you can do to cut down on cheating, because people have proven that they're willing to do it on camera already.
Let's do RFID.
Yeah, I think that's a whole different ballpark to talk about and what's possible there. But I mean, just focusing on how quickly the information can be accessed efficiently, you know, I think that's just the biggest piece of it, piece of the puzzle either way.
I will say the one thing I'm not a fan of is the new font.
Really?
Like the F on the Wall of Fire looks kind of weird. The parentheses that store rules text, they at the top, like at the edge, because they're slanted, they hit the text, and it's kind of awkward. But, you know, that's literally like a millimeter kind of complaint. So it's, yeah. Well, I'm not going to say it matters.
I think the rules text fonts. The rules tech font didn't change. Strictly the card name and type font is now unique.
Well, look at the parentheses changed on the it abuts the letters on the one that they put in the that they demonstrated.
I think that's kerning. I think that was just the kerning that they have on the card, not the font.
Okay. Well, there you go.
I'm pretty sure it specifically said the font didn't change for the rules.
Well, there you go. It was something. I know it caught my eye as a, you know, as an editor and person who has dealt with kerning issues plenty of times. That immediately caught my eye when I was looking at it. I was like, ah, it's too close.
No, I totally saw it too, and I thought it was really, I thought it was actually telling, because I think it means that that it seems like they want to solve some of the foreign language issues where, mm-hmm. like, have you seen some of the German cards?
No.
Like, really? like, it's like Ice Cauldron for half the set. So I think that by expanding the text box and adjusting the kerning in, like, it looks slightly weird to us because we're used to more space, but I think it actually makes an improvement for some of their localizations.
Yeah.
Now I was mid snarky comment about how these new foil stamps aren't going to stop anybody from counterfeiting duels and power and stuff that people are actually counterfeiting. And right then, I think it was Caleb Durward posted a picture on Twitter of a really, really convincing fake Tarmogoyf that was pretty much distinguishable by the font, and that was about it. So there are, you know, Modern Masters cards worth counterfeiting. Like, no one's going to counterfeit a Waste Knot, you know, like we saw in Mr. Forsyth's article, but I think a Modern Masters Tarmogoyf is probably ripe for counterfeiting, so this could probably solve a lot of those issues.
Yeah, for the expensive cards that, you know, come in Modern Masters 2, for instance, like, that's a set that will surely have a bunch of expensive cards where it would have a new card frame and it would matter to keep them from being counterfeited.
I think people forget that counterfeiting isn't about, really, for Wizards, it really isn't about singles. It's about mass market and distribution. So, like, for example, you know, in a country like Russia or China, where, you know, perhaps, the copyright enforcement and product enforcement isn't quite as rich or, strong as here, like in the States or in Europe. You can have companies just spring up, print and produce a bunch of counterfeit product and offload it and flood a market with fake cards. And so this helps rein in things like where, like if you go to Taiwan, you know, they have the markets where very famously you can just like buy, you know, all of those like really fake ripoff movies and like fake movies, and it's very clearly fake, but some of the fakes aren't very fake. Like they look very real. And I think that that's also heading that off, which is a much bigger concern globally.
It's all positive for Magic, showing that they're caring and they're moving forward and they're willing to make change. And they send it through the mouth of Aaron Forsythe, so people really can't mouth off too bad about it, unless they won't get their legs broken.
All right, so are we ready to move on to these picks of the week?
Let's do it.
You tell me. You're the one that sidetracked us last time.
Did do that. That's true. All right, I'll start us off, even.
Why? Why do you get to start?
Yeah, I know. It's yours.
No, you're at the end of the line now, Corbin, because you messed up last time.
All right, I'll go last.
All right, so my pick of the week is going to be, for Modo, of course, is going to be Obsidet. Obsidet is reaching, it's at 1650 right now. And this is due to the Humans deck, the black-white Humans decks that have been seeing more play on Magic Online. Historically, the card reached about 20 tops, so it could go a little bit higher probably by the time Friday when the cast comes out. It may hit the 18, 19 mark, and I would sell around there. It cratered off. It hit about 8 not too long ago, and I think it's just part of the hype of this deck, and eventually it'll drop back down because Blood Baron is probably a better card in the long term. And, get rid of the card while you can if you got your play sets. If you bought in at some point, you know, get your money out, and yeah, I'm sure it'll dip back down to $8 again if you wanted to buy in and play with it. But, I get out while it hits its peak.
Man, Obsidet is too good with Whip for the amount of play it's not getting.
Yeah.
I guess that sort of strategy just isn't right for this current format.
It's interesting though, on paper, the card's down. When Modo, you see like a crater. Where in paper, it's a steady slide back down. So I don't know about Modo. Paper might be a good pick. Possibly. I don't know. But I'm going to throw in a little bonus. Tristani is $3 on Modo. And I grabbed a few copies just because if green-white does take off with the new temple coming out, Tristani will be a factor. So I think $3 is pretty cheap.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of like aggro decks that are kind of starting to pop up right now that green-white Tristani thing could be really relevant.
Well, if you look at Andrew Shrout was running a green-white deck that would at least benefit from Tristani out of the board, if not main.
Yeah, $3, I could see it become a $5, $6 card, maybe an $8 card again. Maybe.
I'm really bullish on green-white cards with the next set in the Scryland coming out.
Yeah,
please. Only for you. Okay. Well, that's interesting. Speaking of Andrew Shrout's deck, my pick of the week involves a card that we've seen in that. We've seen in other, the green-red monstrous deck. There's a lot of green-based decks that are being built from the ground up to beat the mono-blue. So I think Andrew Shrout was running something like 2 Skylashers main, but he was running a full complement of this card, Mistcutter Hydra. Hydra's gettable for about 250 on TCG player right now. I think it's got nowhere to go but up. Everybody that wants them is starting to jam for them. It's no longer a sideboard card. It's become a mainboard card. Its uncounterability could be relevant outside of just being played against mono blue. Pro blue and haste are, you know, obviously very good abilities. It's a Hydra, so it's got long-term casual appeal. I like everything about Mistcutter Hydra at around $2. So now, when this first came out, I didn't like it at 450 or whatever it was pre-ordering for. Now that it's down around 250, I think this is a real good pickup.
So considering that, you know, it's in Theros. Theros is getting drafted as a 3 of and still going to be drafted for a while to come. How high do you think it can go?
I think it could go back to the $4 or $5 we were seeing for the pre-order, especially with it being a 4 of.
I don't know if that 4 of is going to remain post-road with the new set coming out. I think we're going to see blue and black devotion get knocked on their ass a little bit.
Well, I mean, those cards, I mean, blue and black have their Scryland. Black and white have their Scryland. That's why, like, I know it's kind of like simplistic to say, well, these colors don't have their lands, so, you know, they're not good. But like, I think it really, like, in the mono black, people were on scry lands just to have a scry trigger. I think like red black and green white, have a lot of chances once they get theirs.
Well, he's still an X power creature that can't be countered.
Like, oh yeah. It's a good
with
card.
With haste. I think it's very good. And I don't think $2 is correct.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Mono Blue's going anywhere. So, you know, by extension, that means Mistcutter Hydra is likely not going anywhere.
I want to take you guys on a trip. Go back to Grand Prix Louisville a couple months ago. I was there doing coverage, and I watched John Stern just demolish people with Mistcutter Hydra in a very average-looking Gruul Beats kind of aggro deck. The fact that it costs one green makes it easy to cast, so you don't necessarily need to rely on having a dual land, like a shock land or a scry land on tap first to be able to get it off. Uncounterable in haste, you know, it just totally changes the math on damage. You know, somebody who's counting on a Sphinx's Revelation in three turns, cutting it down to two turns and making the math, you know, terrible for them makes a huge difference.
You know, I'd love to play with this card with a Domri Raid against a blue deck.
I'm going to go with a modern card that I'm going to talk about because it seems like every modern card that's fringe playable now is going to increase 1,000% randomly one day. But yeah, I'll actually give Brian Clymer, who did, you know, our Seder token, some credit for this because he tipped me off to this several months ago, and I know he's gone deep on them himself, and I think it's not bad. And that card is Torpor Orb. It's basically a buck. I mean, it's available for under a dollar on TCG Player. It's gone up average from 50 cents to a dollar in the last two or three months, but it's basically a card that's all over sideboards in modern season. And you know, I don't think it's going to be like some big spike or anything like that, and it's obviously not really going to get run main deck. But if you look at some of the sideboard cards in modern that are two to four of in the sideboard, when everyone needs a couple of them, it kind of starts to add up. So I'm going to go with Torpor Orb. I think it's probably going to be like $3 in modern season, and that's, you know, you can get these for, you know, very nearly free right now when you're trading especially. So I think there's very little risk and the potential, you know, I don't even know if I could pretend to say I know what modern cards do these days. This card could hit $5. It could spike to $10 for a couple of days. Just the market is behaving so erratically recently, but I don't think you can lose with a card that has a unique effect that is played in a lot of sideboards.
Could this go higher than Grafdigger's Cage? And if so, how?
Well,
considering Grafdigger's Cage is going to get played in more formats.
Yes, because of the set. I mean, New Phyrexia, I mean, it's not like Dark Ascension lit the world on fire with how much it was open, but New Phyrexia was open less, for sure. And this shuts down, it shuts down a lot, because like, Grafdigger's Cage stops obviously a lot of things that Pod does, but it doesn't stop like Splinter Twin, and it doesn't stop the Pod from drawing the creatures that destroy the Grafdigger's Cage. He doesn't have to search for them. So it's got a little more versatility than Grafdigger's Cage.
I'm not suggesting one or the other, like, in that spot. I'm just saying Grafdigger's Cage is, like, you're talking a sideboard card, and
yep.
I think Grafdigger's Cage is a sideboard card that impacts more formats.
Well, I could be wrong, but I'm under the impression that Torpor Orb is played in more sideboards than Grafdigger's Cage. I mean, it's obviously, there's a long way to go before the, like, it's been so long since there's been a modern PTQ season, and there's gonna be several more months before there is a modern PTQ season for things to shake out. But, you know, I think at a dollar, it's hard to lose, and I think it's got more, the potential to be played more than Grafdigger's Cage. It's older than Grafdigger's Cage, which lead me to believe it can be worth more than Grafdigger's Cage.
Okay. I just wanted to make you defend yourself.
What's the mana cost on Torpor Orb?
Two colors.
What's the mana cost on Grafdigger's Cage?
One.
I am gonna give the edge towards Grafdigger's Cage.
I mean, maybe. It's a thing.
I would need to see something compelling that would make me believe that there's more profit potential. Cause we've seen Grafdigger's Cage just go nowhere. It's puzzling, but at the same time, like, that's sort of how it is. So I wanted to be convinced that Torpor Orb could be more than Grafdigger's Cage.
Enough. Well, I mean, like, on the topic of older formats and such, you guys are concentrating a little more on Standard, and Corbin kind of ventured off there. I think with this recent Stoneforge spike, I mean, that we're going to talk about here in a second, that we really have to kind of look at the equipment that's going along with it in Legacy. And, I mean, you see things like, the, you know, Sword of Feast and Fame and stuff jump pretty recently, and you have the Sword of Fire and Ice reprint and that kind of stuff, and I don't expect any of those to go up, but one that really hasn't spiked in a while is Jitty. And it's getting just as much play, if not more now, without seeing any of the added benefits of, you know, the price going up any. And I've seen it slowly kind of be selling online, and it seems like a lot of the auction sites are running lower on copies than they were 6 months ago. It's definitely not flooded in the same way, but I don't think it's going to be something that's going to happen you know, slowly and go up $5 here, $5 there. I think it's going to be another one of those cards where all of a sudden it's worth twice as much as it was. And I wouldn't be surprised to see it, even with the promo being $50 plus in a few months, if this continues with True Name Nemesis. And I think a lot of that also has to do with whether or not True Name gets banned, but barring the banning, I think it's a good pickup.
It certainly doesn't seem like a bad pickup. I mean, it's a jit, and it's always played and going to be played, if the last 5 years of Magic history tells us anything.
So what do you think is the ceiling on Jitte?
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised to see it make 50. I don't know. the pro ones are 40 now, yep. And they're sold out in a lot of places, and I have seen the regular ones go as low as 20, but I think that's just majorly because people haven't really necessarily been looking at the market and saying, you know, I need to buy a 4X. It's been 1X at a time, but slowly the market's running out, and there's not as many people putting as many up as there are selling out, and you're going to get to a point where there's only 10, 20 copies left on something like TCG Player, and suddenly somebody's going to go, oh, shoot, this is running low, and the same thing's going to happen that happened with Stoneforge, and that's why Stoneforge all of a sudden doubled. And so you might as well be ahead of the train on the next one, and I think Jitte is the next thing to probably go up.
So you think it's going to be a price correction, and you think that price correction is 40-plus?
I think so. I mean, if you really look at how rare it is comparatively to the swords, like why can Sword of Fire and Ice with two reprints be, $30 and actually see less play than Jitte does?
But Jitte is a one-of, and it was in all those rat's nests, and I think every rat's nest in America was opened.
Sure.
Legal and modern.
But I would venture to say that there are still more Sword of Fire and Ices out there than there are Jeets. Not though with the Grand Prix promo. It's probably pretty close. But either way, you have that reprint, and Sword doesn't actually see play in Legacy, whereas Jeet does. So you still have the casual appeal of, Jeet being this, legendary artifact, and people, it's a little hesitant to run it in some EDH decks, I imagine, as people remember how brutal it was in Standard. It probably doesn't have the same kind of fun appeal, but I think that for competitive players, for sure. It's, like I said, you can slowly see that the market's been, selling out on them. And it's only a matter of time until that card's going to go up. And I think it's going to be sooner rather than later.
All right. So, speaking of cards going up sooner rather than later, like you said, Stoneforge Mystic doubled, basically, in price over the last week. Now, do you guys think that this is, a hype buyout? Do you think it's a price correction due to how much Legacy play it's seen? You know, where you guys fall on this?
Price correction.
I think it's an overcorrection, but I think Marcel's right. It's a price correction. I don't know that it'll stay at 30, but 15 is definitely wrong. I don't know if 30's right, but I do know that 15's wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I think when this first came up, when the card was a week or two ago, it went from 10 to 12, and we're talking about upward movement. And I was like, yeah, this is probably a $20 card in a couple months, and all of a sudden it just hits 30. I think 20-ish to 25 is probably where it's going to settle.
Will anybody be surprised if it doesn't?
If it stays higher or if it goes lower?
If it stays higher.
I would not be surprised if it stays between 25 and 30, no. I mean, it is a card that, people remember Stoneforge being so busted and all this stuff. And no, I don't think they're going to put it in a standard set. But, if Batterskull or Jitte aren't in the format, there's really not a lot of danger in putting it in a Commander product or, assuming Commander's off, the Plane Chase product or whatever the next casual product that comes out next summer is. I mean, Stoneforge, with the majority of artifacts, is fair. So I can see it getting worked into one of those products. So, I don't think it's a card you want to sit on for 3 or 4 years and just bank on it never being reprinted. But, if you want to play with them, I think the price is pretty stable.
It's been a while since I had to build a Modern deck. Is Stoneforge Mystic banned in Modern?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Too bad.
Because you could go get a Batterskull.
Right, I was just thinking towards I'm looking forward to Modern Masters too. I could totally see a couple pieces of sweet equipment at Uncommon and Stoneforge Mystic being a mythic in there, but
right,
probably not.
I mean, people have suggested, hey, why don't they just ban Batterskull? But I mean, that's not really how they work. They don't ban. They ban the engine always, and the engine's Stoneforge. So I don't necessarily see it coming unbanned anytime soon.
Yeah, they had an article that talked about cards in Modern and why certain cards would not get unbanned and the reason why they'll never be unbanned. And there's a good valid point for that. It's just the tutoring is just makes it too consistent. It's too powerful. The uncounterability is just too efficient of a card for Modern.
They don't really any kind of tutors in Modern.
Well, I mean, they don't really like them in Legacy either, but Legacy's more equipped to deal with them. But I mean, that's why survival got banned. It's just, and I mean, modern, there haven't been any, you know, we talk about modern having a lot of cards banned. There haven't been any cards banned for a little while now. It seems like, the format's kind of adjusted and found its own way. And there's nothing like, even Deathrite Shaman is not like people were clamoring for its ban 6 months ago. It's kind of fallen off now.
Yeah, Modern keeps like developing too. Like everyone after GP Detroit, there was like, oh, you got to ban Deathrite. But then we never saw that many Jund decks all in the top eight again. That was the fluke.
Fuck, sorry, my dog just went ape shit. Hold on.
I was like, well, and Modern keeps developing as a format too. I mean, after GP Detroit, when there are all those Jund decks in the top eight, a lot of people were clamoring for maybe we ban Deathrite, but. Really? That we didn't see another tournament again with that many of the same deck in the top eight. So I think that was probably just a fluke. So Modern keeps shifting and incorporating new cards, so I think it's a pretty healthy format and probably doesn't need a banning.
Yeah, I think the format has changed, and Scavenging News coming out has helped mitigate some of Deathrite's potency. And yeah, I think that's eventually Tarmogoyf is going to reach the same level where it'll be neutered, and the creature bar is going to be raised, that it's going to no longer be as oppressive on the format. And I think that they're going to do that with several cards that they're content with. And it's just going to be the nature of Modern. So we're going to see it. Eventually they're going to figure it out. They're going to get it down, and we'll have a viable format that everyone's going to love and enjoy. It's looking a lot better than it was a year ago. So Modern is definitely being worked on, being tweaked on, and it'll get to the point that we're going to love Modern. So what about predictions for this coming up Standard? You guys got any thoughts? So what about you, Adam? You got any ideas about anything that you'd be interested in coming out with Born of the Gods?
You know, the only thing that comes to mind is when, Mark Rosewater talked about the pantheon of Theros. You know, we got the five monocolored gods in Theros, and, you know, there seems to be, you know, these other gods mentioned on cards, like Lightning Strike talks about, Kuranos or whatever its name is, and then there's, the new, Seaborn Muse, Prophet of Kufrix.
Krufix.
You know, there are these other gods, and they seem to imply that it's gonna be, you know, it looks like they're two color gods. And I think there was a Doug Beyer or, one of the Vorthos, like the Wednesday creative type articles that covered some of that, talking about the other gods of Theros in like one of the Planeswalker guides to Theros. So, that's what I'm kind of most curious about, are like, you know, if we get two color gods, like, how does that work? Like, I would assume, like, they have to be indestructible and be devoted too, right? You know, like, what does that mean? You know, what do the two color gods look like, and how easy will they be to turn on, and what abilities will they bring? And I think that we're only going to see devotion get more better tools. Because, you know, it seems with Return to Raptinga and the Shocklands, it seems like, you know, whether the gods have two colors or even if they're double color, they're going to be relatively easy to cast. With the Shocklands and the Scrylands floating around. So that's my prediction, is just more devotion, and they're going to get better tools.
Better tools and multicolor? You think that it's going to open the door back open for the multicolor?
I mean, not even necessarily multicolor, just we're just going to see more devotion cards.
Okay.
You know, it's just a mechanic in the set, and so whether it's on gods or, you know, like Fanatic of Mogus, right? It's a good uncommon. You can draft a deck, you know, it supports the mono red deck that you can draft with it in Theros, but it also turns out, you know, you can just like dome people to death. Gray Merchant of Asphodel was in a day two legacy deck at Grand Prix DC. Mono black devotion with Gray Merchant of Asphodel, day two of a legacy Grand Prix. So I think that devotion is a really strong mechanic, and they're just going to get more things to do with it.
Yeah, sweet. I like the fact that they made Chroma actually playable and powerful, but it's a little too powerful, but it's good to see that. And yeah, I do think that the multicolored gods are going to be interesting, and where they go with it is still to be determined, and we'll see what previews next week, coming out on the 13th, so this will be on Monday, so it'll be coming over the weekend, so this is going to be exciting. Exciting stuff coming up. What about you guys? You guys got anything coming up that you're interested in or anything you heard about?
What is the deal this week with Genesis Wave?
We're talking about Born of the Gods.
You gave me a real vague lead-in, and that's what I want to talk about. I hope Krufix is good because I like Prophet of Krufix. There, can we move on? Oh, I really do like Prophet of Krufix, exactly. Can we actually talk about that card? Because okay. That card's nuts.
All right, well, there you go then. Let's talk about it, but... What are your thoughts on it? You think it's just
I think it's too powerful, not to have a deck right now. I'm hoping the land gives people the, we've already got the land, so I'm hoping, I don't know, maybe, shit, blue green might not even get anything. I don't know.
Kiora. You get a Kiora.
I'm curious.
Kiora, shut up, kid. Ah, I don't even like that card.
Alright, I'm curious how many merfolk we get. That's really the only thing that matters.
I think the answer is probably less than four. I don't even want to be optimistic.
I think it's going to be more than four.
How many are going to be six drops? Because that's the real test.
Hey, how many are going to be playable?
Don't tease me.
I'm not teasing you. I'm actually seriously asking.
Is Kiora a merfolk herself? Is she like a merchick?
She looks like a merfolk.
I think if I remember my Duels of the Planeswalker lore, and I could be totally wrong, that Kiora is a merfolk. So
what's she doing in Theros by herself?
Just other merfolks. They got
it's
the
not a place to put it in, and there are other merfolk.
You got the Wave Crash Titan, and then you got the, was it Treasure Looter?
Master of Waves.
Oh yeah, Master of Waves. That's three right there. I'm sure there's one more, right?
Probably.
They got a one drop merfolk in there, and that's four.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. So I think, talking about profit, Jason, we all know that, you know, it's nothing else a Commander All-Star, and my advice to people has been, you know, wait, the set's still gonna be open for a while. Wait for it. Get the foils for Commander because they'll probably go up long term.
That foil price is not right.
You think it's too cheap right now?
It's way too cheap.
Well, I think it's
like $7 for foil.
It's gonna go even cheaper. I mean, Theros is getting open for another.
It's been flat though. Like, I think it could maybe go down a little bit. Like, the price has just been real flat ever since the pre-order. If you look at something like Chromatic Lantern, that was $15, and everybody went, oh yeah, EDH, it's a $15 card, and now it's like $7. Profit of Crufix has been $7 like the entire time. It hasn't moved by more than 50 cents either direction.
Well, that's like, what I'm like. It's ever, certainly so. Not going to be more expensive after we open Theros for another 3 months. You know, so like, I don't think there's a rush on it. I do think it's a card that could take off in Standard, maybe like after rotation. You know, there's been several cards like that. Maybe it doesn't quite fit right now, but it is so powerful that it could be. You know, probably next, not the next Desecration Demon, maybe the next Pack Rat.
But are we even going to get any blue-green stuff in the next set?
Well, I mean, I assume there's something to go with Kiora. I don't think they're just going to throw her in there by herself.
So we're not getting a temple because we have a temple.
But we're
going to
get
the
blue-green god.
Who knows? Yeah, maybe there's a blue-green god. You never know.
I mean, I kind of alluded to it earlier. Whatever comes in Born of the Gods, I think that the Scrylands are going to have the biggest impact. So I like red-black. I like Ixava because there's already kind of a red-black aggro deck once it gets better mana. I think Ixava is probably not a bad target. And it's got a bunch of uncommons basically besides that and commons in it. But I think that'll be a thing. I think green-white will be a thing because Voice isn't as good with like Last Breath and all that. But like Voice, Fleece Mainline, Advent of the Worm, Tristani, you get the Scryland. There's just so many pieces there.
Like Boonsetter goes part and parcel with those too. Like even the stuff that's already out that's in green or in blue.
I like Advent. Like, I think that's my pick is like, of, if we're talking about post, you know, Born of the Gods, I think green white's gonna be good and Advent of the Worm is still pretty insane. And with Boonsader, it just gives you a lot of ability to play at the end of people's turn.
Yeah, there was a weekend where there was just an Advent of the Worm in every deck in the top eight. And then everyone forgot about it because it's not a mono blue devotion card. So I think Advent's something that people forgot about, but they'll remember.
Yeah, so I mean, let's talk about Kiora and the presale price of, I think, $20-$25.
Quickly.
You guys all feel that's too high, right?
I feel that's too high, and I feel like there is only one deck I actually care about that card for, and it is not even a Standard deck. So,
okay.
In all seriousness, Legacy Lands is the only deck I want to play that card in.
Legacy Lands? I didn't consider that. That's interesting.
Oh, no, you know what? Our good buddy's actually talking about that, running that in Maze's End. Our good buddy Scott Pacer, the Boost Cube.
That's probably a thing in Maze's End.
I mean, potentially, but like in lands, you go like turn one exploration, turn two that card, like it just becomes absurd, and you get the plus one ability, which is like adding another Mazeveth to your deck too. Like it does everything that lands needs it to do. So it actually seems like it may fit into that deck quite well. I'm not sure, but like that's the only place where I saw it, and that was the first thing I thought of. So.
Okay,
Lance is already base green, so that's not terrible.
Yeah, I mean, that seems solid. I certainly didn't look at Kiora and consider Legacy, but that actually makes sense.
But everyone was like, will that impact its price to the same extent that Ral Zeric being good in Vintage? is going to? I don't know.
I mean, it's not going to be...
I'm not saying it's going to make it worth money. I'm just saying that's the only place I really want to play the card.
I mean, yeah, I think everyone agrees it's not $20 or $25 in 3 months, so...
Well, what Planeswalker is? Everyone, you know, charges an arm and a leg just in case a Planeswalker is the next Jace, but I haven't seen a Planeswalker in a real long time that I wanted to pre-order.
You wanted to pre-order Vrazirk. Listen to the After Hours, you were all over it.
What? I think I said that Ral Zarek wanted to suck a dick on Tappet and then suck it again, was my exact quote.
Is that what was it?
That was the exact quote. Yeah. Right. Quote unquote.
All right, so let's go back to the other thing that we talked briefly about and get into it now. It was the big thing of the week, Genesis Wave. For a brief moment in time, and I literally mean about an hour on Tuesday, the card cost $24. And now it's back.
No, it didn't. Yeah. That was a playset. Somebody misreported that someone bought a playset for
$20. Oh, blown out. Okay.
Yes.
So, brief moment in time.
It was $6.
There were very few in the world and, available. And now it is, it's come back down to five or six, even as we record Tuesday night. I think, I don't know if we've talked about it on the cast or if it was in an article or something, but Genesis Wave, after it got cast on me for 23 on turn 5 in Commander a couple weeks ago, I was like, oh yeah, this is probably like a casual Commander staple, in all these like green mana decks, which is basically every green deck. So I really liked it at that price, you know, when it was $2, I thought it'd be 4 or 5. But it's the modern speculation that really drove it. Yeah. What do you guys think about that?
Yeah, it's actually the Heavy Meta SVU. Trevor, he made the Mono Green Devotion deck, and then Gavin, he actually checked it out and picked it up and put it on the site and used it. And so they've been on that card for a little bit. It gets insane. Like, you just go through your entire deck and you get every card that you need. So, I mean, I think the card is good. I wouldn't say it's called a courting level good, but Genesis, you could do a lot with it, especially with Nykthos out, so I think Genesis Wave is a solid card. I don't know if it's a $5 card on Modo, it's up to $1, and that's the highest it's ever been. I don't know, I would probably sell into the hype and then buy it back when it drops down, but...
I mean, it's interesting, the card went up so fast and then back down so fast. I actually think $5, $6 is probably the right price for it at this point. So, like, it's, we usually always say sell into the hype, and maybe... You can still have an opportunity to do that when the cast comes out, but it seems like in paper, like, I mean, the hype existed for about an hour, and now it's basically just got to where it should be.
Hmm. Yeah, this is just one of those cards that, if it gets played at all in a format other than EDH, it's got to be $5-6. So I think this was a price correction, and I don't know. I have real mixed feelings about the role Quiet Speculation played in this, because they noticed it was going up and announced it, and they're kind of getting blamed for the price increase, but I don't know.
I mean, it's a deep conversation. I don't know that we want to get into, but, it seems like the price ended up where it should end up. Nobody's trying to manipulate the market. That's my take on it. Is the price corrected to where it should be?
Yeah, I think the card's that good. I don't know if the deck's that good, but the card's definitely that good. Anyone who's played Omnath in EDH like I have, knows that you top deck that, and if it doesn't get countered, you just win.
Right, exactly.
And with Nykthos in that deck, it's gotten worse. Like, my win percentage is below 50% against my wife now. And that's all the deck. That's not her knowing what to do. That's her remembering to tap all her mana before she plays Genesis Wave.
If it makes you feel any better, my win percentage with my wife when we have disagreements is way below 50%.
That's because you're wrong.
That's because you're wrong.
There you go. That was the joke. All right. Do we have anyone have anything else they want to hit on this week before we head out? Nope. All right. Well, thank you to Adam very much for coming on. And we've enjoyed our year. It's crazy that it's been almost a year now on GM. Thank you for giving us the opportunity and thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, it's been great. Keep it up.
Where can they reach you at, people that don't know?
Well, I'm on Twitter, the_Stybs, STYBS on Twitter. I don't respond to Facebook friend requests if I don't personally know you and like you. So good luck. You can email me at GatheringMagicStybs, STYBS, @GatheringMagic.com. You can also give me feedback on the Mothership. So if you read one of my articles on Daily MTG, you can hit the reply to the author form and tell me all your crazy thoughts.
Check us out next week. This is Praying Stone Brewery. Later. Brainstorm Brewery is brought to you by GatheringMagic.com and CoolStuffInc.com. show your support. So how do you like the Commander decks, Adam?
I think they're great. They feel more cohesive and powerful than the last set of decks. I think that the development team paid a lot more attention to them. I think the new commanders were at least as interesting in a lot of ways as the new ones in the last wave. You know, I think Aaron hit it right on the head in his article, basically saying, you know, True Name Nemesis really skewed everything. You know, I think that the idea of the commander decks would be much more exciting if every deck effectively had a True Name Nemesis in it, or True Name Nemesis was still good, but not quite, you know.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's
$60 good.
Why do they put, like, they knew that was going to be a legacy thing, and they said in the first.
And they put it in the same deck with Strix.
Well, yeah, they want to put some legacy cards in, but, like, I'm just like, why do you want to put legacy cards in casual products? Why don't you just not? Like,
somebody on Reddit today suggested
that they developed it as like a fog bank. They want to sell.
Yeah, well, I know, but those commander decks are going to sell regardless. Like
they won't.
No, they won't. The whole idea of putting legacy specific cards in there is one, you can't safely release them in standard.
I understand. I mean,
and then that's at least the development paradigm is like this is the safest place to add cards to an eternal format. And then in addition to that, the second step is that it's an insurance policy. So like if you didn't put stuff like Baleful Strix in Plane Chase decks, Plane Chase, you know, it's nowhere near as exciting as Commander for a lot of players. But by putting powerful cards in there, it encourages sales that might otherwise completely just rot up in their retailer stores. And that's the thing is I think people misunderstand how important the retail paradigm is for Wizards. You know, it isn't just, these are the stores that sell our product. It's, we want those stores to be successful, to flourish, to feel like the things that we send them are valuable and enrich them and make the stores an advocate for them, for the company. And it's been a very big push, you know, push everything to the stores, organize play to the stores, you know, and so the idea is that by putting those cards in there, I think, you know, again, I don't work for Wizards, so I'm not in the meetings, but from a marketing standpoint, putting the valuable cards in there means even if people don't like the decks, you'll at least get the incidental sales of people just buying for the cards. And it just gets the product to turn.